Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to Islamic History Exclusive. This is the podcast exclusively for Patreon subscribers of the Islamic History Podcast. We are currently discussing the Caliphate / Rebellion of Ibn Zubayr. We are on episode 19 of this series, in which we are discussing some treachery in Syria. But before we get into that story, we will quickly recap where we are so far. Way back in episode 3, we had discussed the tribal strife in Basra. We had mentioned that there were three tribes involved in some of the early conflict after Yazid ibn Muawiyah's death. Three of these tribes were the Bani Bakr, the Bani Azd, and the Bani Tamim. We had also discussed how the Bakr and the Azd had an uneasy alliance against the Tamim. And we also mentioned how that kind of played into the failure of Mukhtar's rebellion to spread to Basra itself. We had also previously mentioned how the Umayyads, very early on in this series about Ibn Zubayr, were split as to who should be the caliph after Yazid ibn Muawiyah and Yazid's son Muawiyah ibn Yazid, also sometimes called Muawiyah II, after both of them had died. There are two primary claims. There was Marwan ibn al-Hakam, who was the former secretary for Uthman ibn Affan. And then there was Yazid ibn Muawiyah's other son, Khalid ibn Yazid. However, he was very young at the time, probably only a teenager. We had mentioned a lot of this, mostly in episode 4, how ultimately Marwan ibn al-Hakam was chosen just before the Battle of Marj Rahit. We had also discussed how Abdul Malik became the Umayyad caliph after Marwan had died. And we mentioned how Abdul Malik sent an army to fight Ibn Zubayr in Iraq, but by the time it reached Iraq, Mukhtar had taken over Kufa, and Mukhtar's army defeated the Umayyads at the Battle of Khazir in 67 AH. This was discussed in episode 14. And so, after that defeat at the Battle of Khazir, Abdul Malik Ibn Marwan once again tries to invade Iraq. So Abdul Malik, in his attempt to invade Iraq again, he had to do a lot of preparation. The loss at the Battle of Khazir in 67 AH was a serious setback for the Umayyads, and it took Abdul Malik almost 2 years to prepare for another invasion. In addition to preparing to invade Iraq, Abdul Malik also had to worry about the Romans. With the Muslim world fractured and divided into all these different competing rulers or competing claims, maybe a better phrase to put it, the Romans, whom we were actually we could now call this version of the Roman Empire the Byzantine Empire, but it was really the Roman Empire just moved to Constantinople instead of Rome. The Romans were preparing to invade Syria again. After all, they had lost Syria to the Muslims during the caliphate of partially Abu Bakr, but mostly during the caliphate of Umar ibn al-Khattab. So to prevent a Roman invasion, Abdul Malik promised to pay the Roman emperor 1,000 gold dinars every week, which you can do the math was over 50,000 gold dinars every year. So with the Romans taken care of or put off for a little while, Abdul Malik could refocus on Iraq, and he finally set off to face Mus'ab ibn Zubayr in Iraq in 69 AH. That was 2 years after the Umayyad defeat at the Battle of Khazir. Now, there are some reports that state Abdul Malik left his second cousin, Amr ibn Sa'id, as his deputy in Damascus when he left off for Iraq. But most of the reports that I found say that actually Amr ibn Sa'id departed with Abdul Malik and when they set off for Iraq. And that probably makes sense because the actual fact is that Abdul Malik did not really trust his cousin, Amr ibn Sa'id. Now let's discuss the relationship between Amr and Abdul Malik. Amr and Abdul Malik, they shared the same distant relative, Umayyah, but they weren't really closely related. Umayyah, of course, is the ancestor that the entire clan was named after. And we partially discussed Marduwan's relationship to Uthman ibn Affan in episode 4. You can go back to listen to that if necessary. But Umayyah, the ancestor of all of these people, had at least three sons that are relevant to this discussion. There was Abul As, who was the father of Affan, who was the father of Uthman. Abul As was also the father of Hakim, who was the father of Marwan, who was the father of Abdul Malik. Another son of Umayyah was Al-As, who only had one son, as far as I can find. His name was Sa'id, and Sa'id was the father of Amr ibn Sa'id, who was the person that Abdul Malik didn't really trust. Another one of Umayyah's sons was Harb, who was the father of Abu Sufyan, who was the father of Muawiyah, who was the father of Yazid. Inshallah, at some point, I will put together a family tree of this so you can see all this visually on the website. So, going back to the story, Amr ibn Sa'id, who was once again not closely related to Abdul Malik, but distantly related, Amr ibn Sa'id had helped Marwan ibn Hakim solidify his claim for the caliphate over another potential caliph, Khalid ibn Yazid. Khalid ibn Yazid was only a teenager when his father, Yazid ibn Muawiyah, died. And then his older brother, Muawiyah II, also died. So in this agreement where Marwan became the caliph, Marwan agreed that Yazid's son Khalid ibn Yazid, and then Amr ibn Sa'id would succeed him. However, when Marwan ibn Hakim did actually become the caliph, he changed things around. He instead made his son, Abdul Malik, his successor, and then made Abdul Aziz, his other son, the successor after Abdul Malik. This, of course, angered and alienated those people who had supported Khalid ibn Yazid's claim. And as far as Amr ibn Sa'id, who had helped Marwan gained the caliphate, Amr ibn Sa'id felt betrayed by Marwan ibn Hakim and then by his son Abdul Malik. And so those feelings were all coming into play, which is why I don't believe that Abdul Malik would have left Amr ibn Sa'id as his deputy over Damascus, knowing that these feelings of betrayal were existing between them. Before the army left Damascus, Amr ibn Sa'id asked Abdul Malik to make him his successor. And in his appeal to Abdul Malik to name Amr ibn Sa'id his successor, Amr ibn Sa'id reminded Abdul Malik of the services he had done in his cause. He reminded him that he had helped his father become caliph in the first place. We discussed this in episode 4. You need a reminder. Essentially, Amr ibn Sa'id advised Marwan ibn Hakim to marry Yazid ibn Muawiyah's widow to nullify Khalid ibn Yazid's claim to the caliphate. And that's, I know that's a lot to remember there, but we also discussed how that didn't quite work out because his wife wound up murdering him. But be that as it may, Amr ibn Sa'id used this as leverage to try to convince Abdul Malik to make him his successor. And then he also reminded Abdul Malik that he was currently preparing to go out with him and fight against Ibn Zubayr. Well, Abdul Malik ignored his request and did not respond, and evidently that made Amr ibn Sa'id pretty angry. Nonetheless, Amr ibn Sa'id left with Abdul Malik and the rest of the Umayyad army on their long trek across Syria and then into northern Iraq to face Mus'ab ibn Zubayr at Mosul. Well, along the way, Amr ibn Sa'id decided to rebel against his cousin. So while they were encamped at the Euphrates River, maybe about a quarter of the distance of along the way, maybe a third to a quarter, it's hard to really tell at which point they actually camped. Amr ibn Sa'id slipped away with his soldiers, returned to Damascus, fortified the city, and prepared for the inevitable siege. Abdul Malik woke up to discover that his cousin Amr ibn Sa'id had abandoned him. And when he realized he had returned to Damascus, he realized what was going on. Abdul Malik called off the march to Mosul, to Iraq, and rushed back to Damascus and immediately placed the city under siege. So now Amr ibn Sa'id is holed up inside of Damascus. Abdul Malik, the current caliph, current Umayyad caliph, is outside besieging the city, and the two sides are starting to fight. Banu Kalb, we mentioned how Banu Kalb was another tribe in Syria that had historically been allied with Banu Umayyah. And in this case, you have Banu Umayyah fighting against Banu Umayyah. And just like Banu Umayyah was split, Banu Kalb was also split. So you had some members of Banu Kalb who supported Amr ibn Sa'id and others who supported Abdul Malik ibn Marwan. So the two sides are fighting, and after several days of fighting with some deaths, the women of Banu Kalb, they began to appeal to their men to stop all of this fighting. And they're asking themselves, why are you killing yourselves for the Quraysh? Why is Kalb killing themselves for the Quraysh? That logic must have eventually seeped into the minds of Banu Kalb, and the two sides of Banu Kalb, they made peace with each other and decided to withdraw from the fighting and let the Umayyads hash this out on their own. Well, when this happened, this, of course, naturally encouraged Amr ibn Sa'id and Abdul Malik to rethink things because they had lost a lot of their support and they were only going to harm themselves and whittle their strength away in their upcoming battle against Ibn Zubayr. And so they also agreed to peace and entered into negotiations. And ultimately, Amr ibn Sa'id agreed to open the gates to Damascus so long as Abdul Malik provided a promise of safety, which Abdul Malik did. He guaranteed his safety and re-entered Damascus. So now Abdul Malik has reclaimed Damascus, and seemingly things are going to settle down. Well, 4 days after Abdul Malik re-entered Damascus, he summoned Amr ibn Sa'id to meet him at the palace. Amr ibn Sa'id's wife and his son-in-law, they both begged him not to go and said that it was a trap and that he should ignore his request. Bear in mind that all of these men, even if they're not the caliph, they're not necessarily weak. This is almost a feudal society. The way it sounds and the way it's being described, it may not have been set in stone, such as a feudal laws of Europe, but this is almost a feudal society with nobles, whom we call sharif or ashraf in plural, owned large tracts of land in multiple parts of the empire and had bannermen under them, smaller tribes under them, or smaller clans pledged to them. And then below these smaller clans, they may sometimes have had even smaller tribes or clans. And then below that, they also had the maula, the mawali, or freed slaves who were tied to that family, or maybe tied to the various clans that were tied to the larger clans who were tied to different branches of the Umayyad. So even though we might mention individual people, bear in mind that these were fairly powerful and rich men who had lots of other men below them who were pledged to support them. So it is not unnatural for Amr ibn Sa'id to not be afraid of Abdul Malik and to feel somewhat secure, even though Abdul Malik had re-entered Damascus, and to feel so much secure in answering Abdul Malik's summons. And Amr told his wife and his son-in-law exactly that, saying that he was not afraid of Abdul Malik, but nonetheless, Amr ibn Sa'id did take some precautions before he actually went to meet Abdul Malik. He put on armor, and then he put a thobe over the armor. So Amr put a thobe over the armor that he was wearing to protect himself. Then he also strapped on his sword. And then when he did go to the palace, he took along all of his, maybe not all, but a whole troop of his Mawali and his family members to support him. So he went to the palace with a pretty large retinue. He wasn't there alone. And included in his retinue was also his brother, Yahya ibn Sa'id. So Amr ibn Sa'id enters the palace. However, Abdul Malik bars any of his men from entering except for Abdul Malik. So Abdul Malik, even though he took all these men with him, he wound up entering the palace alone. As soon as he was alone with Abdul Malik, Abdul Malik had his servants disarm Amr, and then they sat down. They started talking for a while as if everything was friendly. And then they were joking about the rebellion and about Amr's attempt to overthrow Abdul Malik, kind of joking about it. And Abdul Malik mentioned something about how he had promised to that he had Abdul Malik told Amr that after he had reconquered Damascus that he was going to have Amr ibn Sa'id put in shackles. And they were joking about this. Amr ibn Sa'id joked about it, says, surely you won't parade me before my bannermen and before the other chiefs of the Quraysh in shackles, will you? And Abdul Malik, joking and everything, took out a set of shackles and tossed them over to Amr ibn Sa'id, and then had his servant shackle Amr ibn Sa'id. And at this point in time, the jokes stopped coming so much. Amr ibn Sa'id is still kind of jovial, but there's a bit of caution in his voice. The servant shackles Amr's chains, Amr's wrists, and the way the Tariqa Tabari describes the shackles, that they were basically two brackets around the wrist that were chained to another chain that was then attached to his neck. So he had basically shackles around his wrists and shackles around his neck that were connected to each other by chains. And so now Amr ibn Sa'id is pretty much stuck. Abdul Malik had disarmed him. His men are all outside, and now he's also shackled up inside the palace. So Amr ibn Sa'id kind of got himself set up here. But still, Amr ibn Sa'id is kind of joking, saying that you're not going to basically parade me in front of the other Quraysh like this, are you? And Abdul Malik says, oh no, I'm not going to parade you in chains before the other Quraysh, which has a double meaning. One, that he was going to parade him in front of the other people, but also two, that he was going to kill him first. The truth finally begins to settle in Amr's mind, and he starts wasn't begging for his life. I don't give you that impression, but Amr was surprised because they had a negotiated peace agreement. They had an agreement and a guarantee of safety, and Amr was saying, you won't break your promise of safety, because this is a treacherous thing. A ruler's word is like the main thing he had. And to break your word of treachery, to break your promise or your agreement, that puts you in some very difficult territory. I mean, as a ruler, you got to make agreements and treaties and negotiations with people. And if you have a reputation of breaking that trust, you're not going to get much done. So it was very dangerous and very rare for a ruler or anyone to break their promise, but especially a ruler, because this is pretty much all they really had. This is where their power lay, their ability to have people trust them. And Amr ibn Sa'id was surprised that Abdul Malik was going to break his promise of safety. But Abdul Malik goes on to say that basically Damascus just wasn't big enough for the two of them, that if he left Amr ibn Sa'id alive, that eventually Amr ibn Sa'id would try something like this again. And with that, he reached over, grabbed the chain that was attached to Amr ibn Sa'id's neck and yanked it down, and that smashed Amr ibn Sa'id's face into the side of a couch. And when that happened, all the joking was out the air, and Amr ibn Sa'id realized that he's going to die. So Abdul Malik, he then ordered for his brother Abdul Aziz to execute Amr ibn Sa'id. And just at that moment, the adhan was called for prayer. So Abdul Malik gets up to leave for prayer, expecting his brother to carry out his order. So Abdul Aziz, he has a sword and he's preparing to execute Amr, and Amr begins to appeal to Abdul Aziz, begging him not to kill him for the sake of Allah and for the sake of their family ties. It's not that Amr ibn Sa'id is afraid to die. He's basically telling Abdul Aziz, you're a family member, don't you do it. Have some slave or some other person or some servant do it. Have someone who's not related to me do it. Don't do this yourself and mess up your afterlife. And this kind of hits Abdulaziz in the heart. And so he's shaken by this. And so he just couldn't bring himself to kill his relative. Even though they're distant relatives, they're still relatives within the same clan. So while Abdulaziz is wavering inside the palace, outside the palace in the musalla, where the masjid where they're about to pray, a commotion starts up. As we mentioned, Amr ibn Sa'id's bannermen and supporters and his family members are all outside, and his brother Yahya ibn Sa'id, they start getting concerned when they see Abdul Malik come out for prayer, but not Amr ibn Sa'id. And so immediately Yahya ibn Sa'id and Amr's family begin demanding to see Amr, and when that doesn't happen, the commotion starts. They try to break into the palace, and fighting breaks out between Abdul Malik's soldiers and Amr ibn Sa'id's family. There were some injuries, but no actual deaths in this scuffle between these two sides. Abdul Malik eventually restores some semblance of order. He goes ahead and prays, and then goes back inside the palace, and he's quite surprised to see that Amr ibn Sa'id is still alive. And he asks his brother, I told you to execute this guy. And Abdulaziz says that he appealed to me and I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And so Abdul Malik, he asks for a spear. And he takes the spear and he stabs Amr ibn Sa'id with it. But Amr ibn Sa'id, as we mentioned, he's wearing armor under his thobe. And so when he stabs him, the spear just clangs off of the armor that Amr is wearing. And Abdul Malik actually laughs at this. He laughs and says, you thought of everything, haven't you, Amr? And so he then gives the order. And by the way, so you understand, Abdul Malik is fairly young. I calculated his birth or his age to be about 43 years old at this time. So Abdul Malik then orders his soldiers to force Amr down on the floor. And I'm painting a mental image as I read it. So the soldiers, they force the struggling Amr ibn Sa'id down on the ground. And then Abdul Malik goes and sits on his chest while his soldiers are holding him down. He asks his servant to give him a knife. And with his own hands, which is extremely rare, Abdul Malik slits Amr ibn Sa'id's throat immediately after killing his distant cousin. Abdul Malik begins crying and he's shaking, and his men pick him up and take him off of Amr's body and then lay him down on his bed. Finally, Amr ibn Sa'id's family, they break through into the palace and they rush in and they see that Amr ibn Sa'id is dead. And Yahya ibn Sa'id, Amr's brother, is extremely angry. He starts cursing the two brothers, Abdul Malik and Abdul Aziz. He curses at them. He's yelling at them. And once again, fighting breaks out between the two groups, between Amr ibn Sa'id's family and the soldiers and everything supporting Abdul Malik. But ultimately, and this is a part of the story I don't really truly understand, but this is what was in Tariq al-Tabari. Abdul Aziz, Abdul Malik's brother, he removes Amr ibn Sa'id's head and then throws it at the people along with some money. And for some reason, that made them all disperse. I don't really understand that part. I don't see how that would make this family who's grieving and who's shocked at the death of their leader, their own Sharif, because Amr ibn Sa'id was the leader of this branch of the Umayyad clan. I don't see how that would make them disperse. But the fact of the matter is, that's what Tariq al-Tabari says in his book. So they disperse and they leave the palace and they take Amr ibn Sa'id's body with them. So later that evening, after the commotion had died down a bit, Abdul Malik decides to expand the purge. Not just Amr ibn Sa'id, he now gives out orders for all of Amr ibn Sa'id's supporters to be arrested. He ordered the arrest of Yahya ibn Sa'id. He ordered for the arrest of basically all of Amr ibn Sa'id's supporters one by one, and he gives the order for them all to be executed. So let me put it in a different context. Instead, he ordered for them all to be executed. I'm sorry, to be arrested. And when they're brought before him, he then gives the order for them to be executed. But each time he gives the order for the execution, Abdulaziz stands up and intercedes for them. And Abdulaziz asks his brother, Abdul Malik, are you going to kill off all of Banu Umayyah in one day? And when he does this, this kind of makes Abdul Malik rethink it, and instead he has them imprisoned. So one by one, Amr ibn Sa'id's supporters are brought through, Abdul Malik orders the execution, and Abdulaziz intercedes for them. And then the supporters from among Banu Kalb, who had supported Amr ibn Sa'id, they are also brought in. And again, Abdulaziz, he goes to intercede for them as well. So a lot of people were put in prison by Abdul Malik, but none of them were executed. So you understand who Abdulaziz was, by the way. He did refrain from killing his relative, and he did intercede for a whole bunch of people. But I don't know if you know this from his name, but Abdulaziz is the father of a young boy named Omar. Omar is about 10 years old. Omar ibn Abdulaziz, of course, would be a later Umayyad caliph and perhaps one of the only true righteous Umayyad caliphs, one of the few true, really righteous Umayyad caliphs. And even though Omar ibn Abdulaziz didn't rule for that long, he is still sometimes called the fifth righteous caliph in Islam after the first four. So at this point in time, as I mentioned, Omar ibn Abdulaziz is probably about 10 years old. He's probably off in Egypt because remember, his father, Abdulaziz, was the governor of Egypt, and he remained the governor for well over 20 years. And another interesting fact is that Omar ibn Abdulaziz, his mother was actually the granddaughter of the second caliph, Omar ibn al-Khattab. So Allah knows best, but hopefully with Abdulaziz having some level of righteousness within him, not, you know, interceding for so many people and not wanting to kill his relative, even though he didn't really stop his brother from doing so, but still. And then with his mother being the granddaughter of Omar ibn Khattab, perhaps those two things put some bit of righteousness inside of Omar ibn Abdulaziz. On top of that, Omar ibn Abdulaziz was also educated in Medina by the Sahabas and the children of the Sahaba. So he wasn't raised in Damascus like a lot of the other caliphs. He was actually mostly raised between Egypt and Medina. That's a story for a future time. So back to Damascus and our story. So Amr ibn Sa'id's supporters are all imprisoned, and Abdul Malik has to figure out what to do with them. So he asks his advisors about how he should treat them, and some of them do suggest that he should go ahead and execute them. Others, however, suggest that he should instead send them to Iraq and let Musab ibn Zubair deal with them. Essentially, if Musab decides to kill them, well, it's not Abdul Malik's fault. Their death came by somebody else's hand. And if Musab doesn't kill them, then Abdul Malik can figure out what to do with them later on. So that was the course that Abdul Malik decided to take. And he sent all of those people who had supported Amr ibn Sa'id off to Iraq. Musab ibn Zubair, actually, he simply allowed them to settle with their relatives in Iraq and didn't harm them at all. So last thing that Abdul Malik tried to do, he tried to hide his treachery. After Amr ibn Sa'id had been killed and buried, Abdul Malik sent a message to Amr ibn Sa'id's wife demanding that she turn over the peace agreement that they had signed when Ahmed ibn Said had occupied Damascus. And Ahmed's wife replied that she had wrapped that peace agreement inside of Ahmed ibn Said's burial shroud to be used as evidence on Yawm al-Qiyamah, on the Day of Judgment, evidence against Abd al-Malik for betraying and breaking his promise. So now on to Basra, where we have another form of treachery going on. While the Umayyad army was marching from Damascus to Iraq to invade, Mus'ab ibn Zubayr, of course, heard about the army coming, and so he leaves Kufa and Basra, travels north to Mosul to prepare for the army. As the Umayyad army is approaching Iraq, one of the Umayyad commanders, a man named Khalid ibn Abdullah, he offers Abd al-Malik, this is before Abd al-Malik has to return to Damascus, this is before Ahmed ibn Said betrays Abd al-Malik and occupies Damascus. This commander, Khalid ibn Abdullah, asked Abd al-Malik for permission to ride ahead and try to capture Basra. Abd al-Malik agrees and gives him a small cavalry force for the task. So Khalid ibn Abdullah and the small force of men, they ride ahead and rush on to Basra well ahead of Abd al-Malik, who ultimately has to go back to Damascus anyway. But Khalid ibn Abdullah is not aware of all that right now. Mus'ab ibn Zubayr, most of his forces have moved north to deal with the approaching Umayyad army. And so with this, this allows Khalid ibn Abdullah and this small force to infiltrate Basra. So Khalid and his soldiers, they secretly enter the city, and Khalid begins to make contact with some of the Umayyad supporters within Basra. Interestingly, the Umayyads actually had affiliates and supporters among three of the major rival tribes, the Azd, the Bakr, and the Tamim. And so, interestingly, even though these tribes were often at conflict with each other, they were somewhat united. Well, not all of them. Many of the people within these tribes were united in their support of the Umayyads. In any case, this fifth column within Basra that secretly supported the Umayyads, they have an inkling that Mus'ab's deputy, the man he left in charge of Basra while he went to go deal with Abd al-Malik's army, they have a feeling that maybe they could convince him to join their side. And so they send a message to Mus'ab's deputy saying that I have some of Abd al-Malik's men with me. Well, instead of actually joining them, the governor actually, or the deputy actually said, I'm bringing an army to arrest all of you right now. And so he gathers his army and he begins to march towards the area where Khalid ibn Abdullah and the Umayyad secret interlopers are all hanging out. So now it's no longer a secret, and Khalid ibn Abdullah and his supporters within Basra, they are forced now to come out in the open and fight. And eventually, the Mus'ab's deputy and his soldiers come, and Khalid ibn Abdullah and his supporters within Basra, they start to fight. They line up and fight each other for roughly about a month. However, both sides are seriously undermanned. For Khalid ibn Abdullah, he had only come there with a small force of men. He didn't come there with a large cavalry force. Obviously, that would not have been a secret. And the point of it all was to infiltrate Basra and secretly raise support for the Umayyads in Basra. So Khalid ibn Abdullah and the Umayyads weren't really prepared for a long, drawn-out fight. On top of that, even though they did have some supporters, most of the men were way up north in Mosul preparing for what they thought was going to be a battle between Mus'ab and Abd al-Malik. also for Musab's deputy in Basra, the guy who had brought the army together to fight them, he was also in demand because, once again, most of the men are up north preparing to fight Abd al-Malik. So even though eventually the word of this fight gets out and both Abd al-Malik and Musab hear about this attempt to overthrow Basra and both of them send more soldiers down to support each side, basically it wound up being a stalemate and no side could really gain the advantage over the other. And so with all this going on and them both being undermanned and not really being prepared for a true battle, they enter peace negotiations, and Musab's deputy, he simply wants Khalid ibn Abdullah and his guys to get out of Basra. That's all he really wants. He ultimately reaches an agreement with Khalid ibn Abdullah, well, really with the Umayyad supporters of Basra, because Khalid ibn Abdullah is the guy who's not supposed to be there. He reaches an agreement that if they kick Khalid and his men out of Basra, then he would not punish those who had turned against Musab ibn Zubair and who were secretly Umayyad sympathizers, which, of course, they took and they were happy with it. And Khalid ibn Abdullah and his men make a very quick exit out of Basra. But no one expected for Amr ibn Sa'id to betray Abd al-Malik and occupy Damascus. And so, when Abd al-Malik suddenly pulled up stakes and rushed back to Damascus, Musab suddenly had his hands free and he can now focus on Basra. However, by the time he gets back down to Basra, he realizes that not only did the Umayyad, Khalid ibn Abdullah and his Umayyads escape, but the people within Basra who had supported them were still alive and well, and they had a guarantee from his deputy not to punish them. Musab ibn Zubair was livid. He was so angry and upset at his deputy giving these guys a guarantee of safety. I guess if Musab was like Abd al-Malik, he would have said, forget that, killing everybody, but he didn't do that. He did punish them. We're going to get into that right now. So he gathered all the men who had sided with the Umayyads. He gathered all of them, including his deputy who had let them all go. He gathered all of them up and he laid into them with curses. He cursed them so badly, even translated in Tariqa Tabari, it still sounded bad even in English. He cursed them. He berated them. He slandered and cursed their entire lineage. He called some of them sons of female dogs, you know what I do literally mean that. He called them sons of female dogs. He called them sons of prostitutes. Oh, he cursed them badly. Even, like I said, even translated in English from Arabic, it still sounds bad. Now, he couldn't kill them because of his deputy's guarantee of safety, but he punished them in other ways. After cursing and verbally abusing all of them, he had all of them whipped 100 lashes. He shaved off their heads and beards, forced them to sit in the hot sun for 3 days with no hair on their face and with nothing but their underwear on. He destroyed all of their homes. He made them divorce their wives. He then sent their sons off to fight the Khawarij in different distant parts of Persia. And then he had them paraded around Basra as people could mock them. And then finally he made them swear not to marry any free women within Basra. So all of that was still a serious humiliation. But ultimately, Musab missed a very good chance to crush a potential anti-revolt or rebellion against the rebellion or whatever it was. He missed a very good chance to crush a fifth column within Ibn Zubair's territory. So that's going to end it for this episode. But before we go, I just want to do a brief analysis and what we can learn from this episode. This episode, or the things that happened in this episode, clearly show the weaknesses of Ibn Zubair's rule. The Umayyads were actually able to infiltrate one of his cities. I can't even imagine Ibn Zubayr being able to do that. I'm pretty sure Ibn Zubayr had spies in Syria. I'm certain he had his own spies and intelligence network in Syria. But the Umayyads, they were able to almost pull up an entire force of men and gathered these people from rival tribes. The Bani Bakr, the Bani Az, and the Bani Tamim generally didn't like each other. And even still within that, they were able to find supporters from all three of those tribes to unite with each other against Ibn Zubayr. Now, we saw clearly that there were divisions among the Umayyads also, but they weren't nearly as bad nor as deep as those among Ibn Zubayr's people. So another thing I want to also mention is that it is clear that Ibn Zubayr is on the defensive. This is the Umayyads' second attempt to invade Iraq. They did it the first time, and they are turned back by Mukhtar and his Shiite force. This is now their second attempt, and they had also previously made an attempt to invade the Hejaz. All this time, Ibn Zubayr has not made a single attempt to invade Syria at all. He is constantly on the defensive. He couldn't even deal with the Khawarij within his own territory. As we mentioned in the previous episode, a whole chunk of Arabia was under Khawarij control. Almost all of Persia beyond the Zagros Mountains was either under independent tribal control or under the Khawarij. The Khawarij had a Yamama in Central Arabia and had several outposts out there in Persia as well. So Ibn Zubayr, his control really isn't all that strong, as we can see, and appears to be getting weaker. Inshallah, in the next episode, we are going to discuss Abdul Malik's return to Iraq. Yeah, he's going to come back to Iraq to face Mus'ab ibn Zubayr one more time. So there's not much more to say about that. We'll see what happens, inshallah, in the next episode. But before we wrap it up, I want you to it's obvious that we're coming to the end of this series. I think we can see that the end is near one way or the other. So I don't know how many episodes we have left. I haven't prepared them all in advance. I'm guessing maybe about 4 or 5, maybe a little bit more. But we're coming to the end of this series on Ibn Zubayr. And I would like to start preparing and planning for the next series. I have 2 current ideas, and there aren't many people who listen to Islamic History Exclusive, maybe about 40 people or so, maybe a little bit more now. But if you are a subscriber to this podcast, I appreciate your input on how you would like for us to, what topic you want me to consider for the next series. There's really only 2 choices. Okay? You only have 2 choices. I'm sorry. Either we can continue the story of the Islamic Caliphate and continue the story of the Banu Umayyah, or another topic I've been kind of interested in recently is the life of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi. And if we do go and discuss the life of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi, of course, the Muslim hero of the Crusades, then we will ultimately, inshallah, return to the Caliphate. It'll just be at a later date. And so many of you know how to reach me. You can either do it through Patreon. You can find me on Twitter. Some of you even have contacted me personally. That's okay. Twitter, Instagram. I have many ways to contact me. You can find some way to contact me, inshallah. Let me know what your preference is. And if one way or the other, hopefully, whatever you decide, I will, inshallah, consider it. Take it into serious consideration. But that's for another time. Inshallah, we will continue the story of Ibn Zubayr in the next episode. But until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.